From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Yang Huang, whose new collection of linked stories is My Old Faithful, winner of the Juniper Prize. Yang Huang grew up in China and came to the United States to study computer science. While working as an engineer, she attended Boston College and earned an MFA from the University of Arizona. She is the winner of the 2017 Juniper Prize for Fiction, as I mentioned. Her debut novel, Living Treasures, won the Nautilus Award, Silver Medal in Fiction. Her essays, stories, and screenplay have appeared in The Margins, 1111, Asian Pacific American Journal, The Evansville Review, Futures, Porcupine Literary Arts Magazine, New Vein, and Stories for Film. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area and works for the University of California at Berkeley. Evoking both the drama of familial intimacy and the ups and downs of the everyday, My Old Faithful introduces readers to a close-knit Chinese family. These 10 interconnected short stories, which take place in China and the United States over a 30-year period, merge to paint a nuanced portrait of family life, full of pain, surprises, and subtle acts of courage. Richly textured narratives from the mother, the father, the son, and the daughters play out against the backdrop of China's social and economic change. With quiet humor and sharp insight into the ordinary, Yang Huang writes of a father who spanks his son out of love, a brother who betrays his sister, and a young woman who dares bring a brown man home to her conservative parents. She writes of an aging wife and the kindness she shows a young prostitute caught soliciting her husband, of a woman returning to China after many years to find her country changed in ways both expected and startling. This collection, by a writer who grew up in Jiangsu province and participated in the 1989 student uprisings, is remarkable in its sense of place and fidelity to lived human experience. When I spoke with Yang Huang, I asked her to start by talking about her background. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I was born and raised in China. I grew up with my grandparents' household.
Oh.
And then I returned to live with my parents when I was school age. So I learned a few dialects before I learned to speak Mandarin, you know, the official Chinese dialect.
Oh. Now, did they live far apart?
In Shanghai, and my family lives in Jiangsu. So it's like 8-hour travel back in those days. Now it's only 4 hours by the bus.
Okay.
It felt like other side of the world. I hardly saw my parents when I was growing up.
And that kind of, yeah. Do you have siblings?
Yes, I have a younger brother.
Okay, and did he also grow up with your grandparents?
He grew up with the other set of grandparents, my mother's side.
Oh, I see.
For the first 2 years of his life, because my mother has some health issues.
Oh, I see.
Then he returned to live with my parents when he was 3. I returned when I was almost 7.
Okay. Now, that's interesting that you learned a couple of different dialects before you learned Mandarin. And one of the reasons I find that interesting is sometimes when I'm interviewing people, I learn that they were multilingual before they became writers. And I think that helps people become interested in language and eventually in writing. Do you think that's possibly true for you?
Yes. I was always very in tune with the language, and I was an observer at a very young age. I was pretty much illiterate until a school age.
Uh-huh.
But I have such good memory about the details. And my grandma used to ask me help to remember the measurement for my auntie's clothes, for example. I was just very good with details. So I had a lot of vivid memories from childhood. I think it helps that I started writing late, and I was immersed in the culture and real life for a very long time.
And did you not write as a child?
I did not write seriously. I wrote diaries, but I knew I didn't have privacy, so I could not pour my, you know, all my inner thoughts into the diary. I was very guarded.
How old were you when you came to the United States?
I was 19. I was an engineering student.
And did you already, had you started writing by that point, or did you start writing after that?
No, after that.
Okay.
I got my engineering degree and I became an engineer. Working as an engineer made me restless.
Oh.
And I went back to school when I was 23. I had a midlife crisis.
That's pretty early for a midlife crisis.
Yeah, but for someone who grew up in a Chinese culture, and you know, we knew about real life at a very young age. So
yeah.
I feel like a part of my, I knew a lot about real life.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned a minute ago that you were a great observer of details as a child, and I was going to say that really comes through in your writing. I think one of the things that helps so much in reading about characters that we're trying to connect with is the very sort of vibrant details that an author brings to the work. And I think you do that really, really well. So I'm wondering, having lived in this country now for a period of time, did you find that the details of life in China were still very accessible to you? Or did you have to sort of call home sometimes and ask someone there to remind you of a certain, cultural event or you know, any of the things that you might have forgotten?
It is both. A lot. I can predict how people act in a certain situation, so that part of detail is very vivid to me and always will be. But the cultural events, not people from all parts of China had the same traditions and rituals. And I did have to research, like, the story Birthday Girl. There's a lot of Buddhist rituals.
Yes.
I read up on it and interviewed people. And traditions change very quickly in China.
Right, yeah.
And it becomes modernized. And a lot of the details became old-fashioned. So in fiction, we can preserve some of the traditions that get lost in the modern life.
Right.
And that's, that makes me love fiction as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about cultural differences. It's interesting because this book really, I felt like I was learning a lot about the culture of the area that this family lives in, and yet, you know, you're writing for maybe you're writing for multiple audiences, but one of your group of readers is going to be Americans. I would expect, you know, a large group of your readers will be Americans, and so you're writing for a different culture, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how that was as an author, you know, writing about things that people who are reading it might need more explication in order to understand. Did you find yourself explaining things that you might not have for a Chinese reader?
Certainly. I think looking back, I could see that this collection was influenced by Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
Louise Erdrich's beautiful book, Love Medicine.
Yeah.
I think the cultural details, it's like a veil. You live to show the human face that we recognize. When I was reading Winesburg, Ohio, I thought those characters were my neighbors in Yangzhou. People are more similar than different.
Yes.
If you describe them precisely. So, in terms of techniques, I try to use flashbacks sparingly and disperse the cultural details in the character actions. For example, in The Birthday Girl, I let the mother act out the Buddhist rituals and argue with the daughter over superstition.
Yes. Yes.
Rather than give long exposition.
Exactly.
Explain the butcher details. And readers are very smart to pick it up.
Yeah, and I loved that the focus of the collection is a single family. You know, these are individual stories that can stand alone, but as a collection, they kind of, they lean on each other, just like Winesburg, Ohio, as you mentioned. And as we go on, they create a more and more detailed picture of a family, but also the place where they live. And, you know, so she's praying in the temple, but at the same time, we get to see her react, her interactions with her daughter, and it's a mother and daughter, and that's very familiar to us. So it was wonderful, you know, it was wonderful to see what's familiar within what's not familiar. The first story is called Pining Yellow. And Yellow is a dog that's missing. The young boy had a yellow dog, and the dog's gone missing, and they suspect perhaps it was stolen. And the father says perhaps it was even stolen to be eaten, which is a very early clue in the book that we're in a very different time and place. But then later in the story, there's also a special chrysanthemum flower that becomes important in the storyline that is yellow. And I loved the intertwined threads of meaning, you know, between these two yellows. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about, you know, interweaving threads of meaning in stories to kind of heighten what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, the chrysanthemum came to me as a surprise. I think it's subconscious. I thought this child misses his dog so much. He's just looking everywhere for his dog.
Yeah.
And this flower comes to him. And in an unexpected moment, I found that the fact that he's carrying yellow with him and finds yellow everywhere is particularly poignant to me. It signified the end of his childhood. But of course, he wants to fight that urge to miss his dog. He just want to do something real and make it appear again. So this innocent fight that actually brings the end of his innocence, in the sense that it shows his resilience for people in that world, that when things don't go your way, you do your best and find a way out. For me, it's how children react in that situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, as I read it again, and I was also a little puzzled by how this came about. I think for adults, it has a different reading, and for a child, he just goes by his instinct, and it's kind of like a puzzle. And for you know, different kind of readers, a different puzzle. My sons, they're teenagers, they read it. They was a little puzzled by this, the American boy. that they were like, why this flower is here? And for Chinese reader, they will see how this came up, you know, it's like a spiritual journey,
yeah,
and materialize in a piece of art. Thought it was very young and also very mature at the same time.
Yeah, the children struck me as more mature than most American children that I know, including my own. You know, it's funny because they fight with each other and they are children, but they have a different sensibility, or, you know, they're just raised in another culture. So there are different things that are going to be meaningful to them. And that really came through in that story, and his appreciation of the flower. And there's a teacher, an art teacher, who's drawing the flower, and he understands her desire to kind of embody this flower in her work. It did seem mature, but it also just really spoke to cultural differences, which in a beautiful way, I thought.
And also, it doesn't matter how bad it gets for the family members, a part of them always remember they are part of the family, always has certain values, and it's a safety net for them. So they always come back to it despite the strivings and even trauma.
Yeah.
Then come back and linger each other.
Yes.
So
It was a pleasure to read about a happy family. I mean, I don't mean to simplify or trivialize their experiences, and it's not that everything's always happy, but they are a family that does lean on each other. And you know, I think we read so much fiction about, you know, just like horrible dysfunction. It was really, I enjoyed this family a lot.
Thank you.
I wonder, Yang, if you can talk a little bit about the benefits and challenges of writing linked stories. My first book was a novel in stories, but they don't stand alone, but they do lean on each other. But I found it to be a really wonderful exercise. I enjoyed writing it. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your experience of writing linked stories.
Yeah. A good short story takes like novels worth of emotional complexity, strips away all the fat, and compresses what's left in a compact space, so makes for a very intense reading experience. The impact of a novel, even the great novels, almost always more diffuse. The readers lose themselves in a longer work and prefer the cumulative effect to a suddenness of impact. I grew up reading more novels than stories, so maybe that's why I'm a fan of linked stories, a book of stories that stand alone pieces, but with reoccurring themes, characters, or settings. So the book achieves a more powerful effect than these individual stories.
Right.
And it is a little humbling to see that I could achieve the emotional closeness in those short stories that I don't always have in a novel told in third person. You know, in a novel, I had more like settings, minor characters, subplots, and growth in the character.
Mm-hmm.
But in a short story, you can just condense. For this collection, I set out to write about the defining moments of each character's life, even though it's a very short vignette, but it says a lot about a character.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real talent, is to be able to, in the compressed form that is a story, you know, show a lot about a person and their character through just the smallest moments or details. And you definitely convey all of these people in their own different lives very well. Let's talk a little bit about the titles. I enjoyed what you did. So each story has its own title, but it's also got sort of a preface to the title. So one of the stories is called The Match, but the preface is what the younger daughter once aspired to, ... So we know that we're in the younger daughter's point of view as we start the story, and we know that the words "the match" will have some important role. And I liked that your titles sort of had more guidance for us than some stories have. And then there's also Chinese characters at the very beginning. So I was going to ask you about what those actually say and how you came up with these title styles.
The Chinese characters just say who they are. So basically, first story is told by son, that's his son. The second story is by father. Third story is by the mother.
Okay.
I let each character tell two stories and the peripheral characters in other people's stories. So the title shows who is a narrator and where I want to tell you basically what defining moments of that character's life. Yeah, it's a clue
right
what the story is about.
Right, and it's not just, you know, because a lot of times we'll read stories or novels where the chapter headings might say, you know, Helen or, you know, Steve. But I liked that yours said what the son did and what the father wanted. And so there's a verb involved, too. It's giving us a little bit of information about the motivation behind the character in the story, too.
Yes. I want you to want to find out what the story is.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a metaphor there, so I want to make you to make the connection.
Exactly, right. I want to ask you about the one-child policy. So this book starts, I think, in the early 70s. And there's this. There are a number of references in the book to how this family was able to get around the one-child policy, which, of course, is the famous rule that existed in China for a long time, that each family could only have one child. And in one of the early stories, they mention having dodged the one-child policy, which I didn't understand that was something people could do. So what's the history of the one-child policy?
One-child policy was introduced pretty early in the 70s. I think it was around 1973 when my brother was born.
Mm.
Initially, it was just encourage couples to space out their children to be at least 3 years apart. If you don't do that, then the second child will not have the food ration for a few years.
Okay.
After 76, it was strictly enforced in the cities, meaning if you have one child, initially it wasn't like strictly one child. If you have a third child, you will get a hefty fine or even lose your job. After 76, in the early 80s, the punishment is really severe. In the cities, the couple will lose their job. And the child would not be registered as a resident. So essentially, they become a non-citizen in their own country. Mm. They could not go to school. They have no food. And they may even have trouble getting hospital treatments if they get sick. In the countryside, China's a very big country, so the policies were all different in different parts of China.
Sure.
In certain parts of China, like Sichuan province, it was very stringent, and there were forced abortions. There's a lot of cruel treatment for women who dare to break the rule. So it was slowly put into place, and initially just with financial penalty, and it gradually escalates.
Yeah. And now?
Now it's, I think it's pretty much not there anymore. You can have a second child. It's actually called two-child policy.
Okay.
So if you want to have a third child, then you need to get approved. But the penalty is not as severe. But since the whole country has been built upon this premise of one-child policy, you know, all the infrastructure, you know, the schools and all the families, they are so used to one-child policy. And nowadays, it's very hard to coax the couples to have more than one child because the burden is simply too great.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, were the children who weren't registered because their parents chose to ignore the policy, were those children ostracized? Were they treated differently just socially? And also, once the rule went away, did those people get registered?
If the children not registered, they're just not citizens, so they cannot go to school. It's very dire.
And now, are they all citizens?
Not all of them.
No, okay.
Actually, a lot of them still not.
Wow, okay.
They become like, yeah, they become like illegal people in their own country.
Yeah.
It has not changed for these people.
Yeah, okay. This is a big jump in topic, but I saw the, I went online to read a little bit about you, and I saw that there was a film of you reading in Berkeley, and Vikram Chandra introduces you, and he mentions having met you at Breadloaf. So you've been in Vermont, which is where this show is broadcast. So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about your Breadloaf experience.
I loved it. It's so beautiful. It's very humid in summer, which, you know, we Californians are not used to. I met a lot of mentors.
What year were you there?
2009 and 2016.
Okay.
I met incredible writers. Yeah, Vikram Chandra was one of my mentors.
Yeah.
I got two books published from two conferences. I mean, you know, it took many years after the conferences, but that was how it got started, the publishing journey.
Yeah. Did you meet agents at the conferences, or did you just have good writing advice that you took?
Good writing advice and encouragement and just boosting confidence. And I became connected with other writers. A lot of writers' careers took off over the years. It was inspiring to watch. Because I came from the West Coast, and the scene was different. It's great in San Francisco, but it's different. And I met a lot of writers from San Francisco at Brello. And we came back home and became connected. And it's a joy to watch their careers take off.
Yeah.
So you don't feel so lonely anymore.
Yeah, that's good. It does get very...
Vermont is beautiful.
Yeah, it gets very humid here in the summer. And for a long time, when I first lived here for many years, there was no air conditioning in a lot of places. And so in the summers, it was just miserable. But now we have air conditioning.
And the mosquitoes.
Yeah, there's that too. I know everybody always thinks about fall and winter, but we have a pretty intense summer.
But I studied at Boston College for 2 years, so I was familiar with this part of country.
Is that where you got your MFA?
No, I got my MFA at University of Arizona. I love the desert as well.
Oh, okay. So what were you studying at Boston College?
English. Oh. I studied with Elizabeth Graber. Yeah, she's wonderful.
Oh, okay.
She was my first writing teacher.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, great. All right, so we'll go back to my old faithful. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about structuring the collection. And I'm curious if these stories exist in the order in which you wrote them, or if you had to change things as you went, or if you ever decided that the structure needed to be adjusted.
I wrote the stories as standalone pieces. The first two stories I wrote were Homely Girls and Dream Lover, mm-hmm. from the older daughter's point of view. She's the one closest to me personally.
Mm.
Then I wrote Chimney from the father's point of view, about him spanking the son to teach him a lesson. This led me to the son's story, where he takes advantage of his sister.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sensed a pattern. Person's rash action causes serious consequences. The sister tells her story in the match, devastated by broken trust. So one group of stories show this ripple effect.
Right.
For example, the father's rash, spanking his son brings serious consequences that leaves nasty consequences. The other type of stories show another side of character. In The Umbrella, the father is protective of his younger daughter, which contrasts his being a stern disciplinary to his son
mm-hmm.
in Chimney. After I had 10 stories, I grouped them chronologically, and I saw the pattern as selfish youngsters, the willful teenagers, and women in love.
Yeah, okay, right, because those are the three sections of the book. But they are chronological. That's interesting. So did you, you've sort of talked about this just now, but I'm curious, did you discover each character as you went, or did you know who the basic characters were as you began? I mean, did you know this was a family of five, and did you know, sort of what their personalities were a little bit? Or did you discover them as you went?
I started with a family of four, a father, mother, daughter, and son. Somewhere along the way, I conceived a third story for the sister.
Okay.
So I decided to make a younger sister. She's more assertive and spirited. And unfortunately, as the youngest one in the family, he's picked on by the older brother. But she stands her ground and fights back. Yeah.
Yeah.
The structure of the story, this book, is predetermined.
Okay, yeah. Now, as we've already mentioned, the book does this lovely job of subtly showing us details about life in China. And I loved what I learned as I read. I had read about the Cultural Revolution, I had read Life and Death in Shanghai, and I've read a couple other books that take place during the Cultural Revolution. But this is after that, and that's interesting. I don't know of a lot of books that feature China during this time period. And this is a big time period, but I'm talking about the 70s and 80s. But so, you know, just some of the things that come up are ration cards, having a certain status, like this family lives on the ground floor because he's a professor and he doesn't have the status of some of the people that live upstairs. And those are called the cadre. And then there's like just information about the official stance on religion by way of Guanyin, who you present in that story about the mother and her belief system. So I wonder, were there things that you had to omit because they were too foreign to the American reader, or were there things as you went you had to change so that we would understand it better?
I don't think I had to change much at all. 1980s is an interesting time because China was relatively liberal and hungry for the Western philosophy mm-hmm. and culture. So people feel relatively free, but then there's still the shadow of Cultural Revolution in the memory. And this family, for me, is based on the families, you know, my own family and other families I knew during my teen years. We used to live in the community of six apartment buildings. The residents were professors and staff's family at Yangzhou Teachers College. My parents, like all Chinese parents, loved to compare my brother and me to our schoolmates who excelled in studies or had special talent. It was normal for us to have anxiety and feel inadequate. So I was really happy to write about these people who made my teen years miserable. I was especially drawn to the moment's weakness when a person makes a bad, when outwardly decent person makes a bad decision.
Yeah, that was really well done because you maintain, in each case, you maintain their essential humanity, and we understand that these are good people making bad choices when that happens. Nobody is terribly vilified or presented as an antagonist. It's just a bad choice.
Yeah, in a way, I love my villains. If I don't love them, I would not spend so much time going through what they go through.
Right. Now, we do see things changing as the years go by in the stories. And I think the first one that really struck me, I'm sure there were others, but what really struck me was the Nikes. One of the daughters really wants a pair of Nikes in the story about birthdays. So I think I mostly want to know how you decided to present the time period and how much to include and when to begin and end.
For each story?
Well, or the whole arc, maybe, too.
Whole arc is basically on the teen years of the children. It starts with the end of childhood for the brother. And as each child goes through their, you know, sexual awakening, sibling rivalry.
Yes.
And jealousy. Parents go through the aging. I just want to show how they confront life in their own private moments.
And how did you decide to start in the 70s rather than, for example, the 80s?
It is the time when I lived through that period.
Mm-hmm.
When the child began to have a real interaction with the world, with the peers, it began to break out from the family to have a sense of, you know, friendship, even sexual attraction, and they grow up and they have to venture. For the sisters, they have to go to the United States and rebuild their lives away from home.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to show the journey, not only on individuals, but also on the family as a whole, how it affects everyone.
Yeah.
a character goes through a moment of change, how everyone is affected, and even in the ways they're not aware, but affected on a deep personal level.
Yes. Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about language. Obviously the family is all speaking Chinese, but it's all presented in English. But every once in a while, the language pushes forward. There was one moment where they were planning to name their child Lian, which meant one thing, and they changed their minds and decided to name the child Lian, which meant another thing. And that's because they weren't having the boy they were expecting. They had a girl. But it's the same spelling to us as Americans or English speakers. So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about depicting one language in another.
It's not a direct translation in this case. You know, the name has different meaning in Chinese, but the same pronunciation in English. But a lot of it, it's in the context, you know. The life unfolds for these characters in a different pace as it is for the readers. So it may be the moment is not as, it is significant for the characters, but for the reader, they have a different perspective because they can put together other people's stories and reflect on that character's journey. For example, in the story, The Match, when the younger sister, she's not at the end of the story match, she puts on a sundress to go to the bonfire party for high jumpers. She's not upset for missing the high jump events. She feels empowered to be the only one wearing a sundress at the party, why everyone else wears a uniform.
Right.
So it's a big moment for her. But the reader can see what kind of journey she has gone through with the brother, for example.
Yes.
And what she's about to become, a young woman who dates someone from overseas and brings him home to meet the parents. With no small courage.
I
guess in the context of a novel, the character has that perspective that is different from what we could see. So I found that very interesting for me and keeps me going and want to discover their lives in a context of the family life rather than just in that moment in time.
Okay. Yeah. So I also was curious in just the actual language that you use. Did you ever consider putting more Chinese words in and then translating them? Or did you just feel that it was a more fluid read if it's all mainly in English?
I was conflicted at times.
Yeah.
In a way, I wanted to make it easier for the readers just by translating it directly. But at times, I feel it's just not authentic. Or I don't want to cut corners and not tell readers about what that means. For example, the younger daughter's name.
Right. Yeah.
So I did a little bit of both.
Yes.
Just to make sure it doesn't slow down the readers too much, but also can get the message across that, the significance of her name and the mother's hope for her daughter. And
yes. Yeah. And I thought it was, I mean, I always appreciate reading something about another language because that's something I'm fascinated by, but it needs to not slow down a reader. So it was well balanced, I thought. Let's see. Now, Yang, you won the Juniper Prize for fiction for this book. Is that a prize that you submitted the book for, or that your editors submitted the book for, or how does that work? And also, do you submit to awards very often?
I submitted my book to Juniper Prize, actually because a friend, Hasantinka, she won with her book, which is a wonderful collection called The Other One. I met her again at Berlope the second time. I thought maybe I'll try to submit my collection and to my astonishment, and I won. I feel very, very fortunate because I've been sitting on this collection for a number of years.
Oh, wow. And so did the publication come with that prize? Is that how the book ended up getting published by University of Massachusetts Press?
Yes.
Great. Do you submit to other prizes?
Yes.
And
I've had many rejections.
Well, yeah, that's what happens. Do you feel like it's worth it, though, in the long run, having won this prize, you must?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you how fortunate I felt. Yeah, I'm very grateful for the Juniper Prize.
And then your debut novel, which was called Living Treasures, also won an award. Is that how that book got published, or was it already published when it won?
It was published before the award.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about your publishing journey in either case, really?
Yeah, it was not too hard to publish the stories in the small literary journals, but I couldn't get the book published. So I didn't take it personally. I turned to writing novels. I completed 4 novels. Finally, I got Living Treasures published 4 years ago. Then in 2016, I submitted my Old Faithful to Juniper Prize. It was accepted. I was just over the moon.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Who published Living Treasures?
Harvard Square Editions.
Okay. And do you have an agent?
Yes, Barbara Brown.
Okay. And so did you get your agent in the course of publishing these two books or subsequently?
My agent worked closely with me on Living Treasures, so I was very grateful for her guidance. But I submitted the book to Harvard Square Editions and got accepted. It's a small press.
Okay.
They publish wonderful books on social changes, very ambitious books.
Mm-hmm. All right, great. Well, while we're talking about books, I wonder if you can tell us about any books you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners.
Yeah. I'm immersed in Elizabeth Strauss' novel, Olive Kitteridge.
Oh, yeah.
I love the description of characters and ordinary lives. So earthy, relentless, yet resilient as real people are. This is a book I have to reread and experience its profound emotions. There's a biography by Janice Nimra that I loved, titled Daughters of Samurai. In 1871, Japan dispatched 5 young girls to be educated in America. These girls were raised in traditional samurai households, but came to America and grew up as typical American schoolgirls. 10 years later, they returned to Japan, a land grown foreign to them, and determined to revolutionize women's education. This story is impressive both as historical scholarship and suspenseful storytelling.
Yeah.
We don't know what life had in store for these girls. This is so relevant today, how history affects a personal life, and what personal choices define the history. I highly recommend this moving and beautiful story of the early feminism during the oppressive time and across the cultures. Another writer I recommend is Ha Jing. He writes poetry, short stories, and novels in English as a second language. His prose is sensual, meticulous, almost restrained. I loved his novels, Waiting and A Free Life. I'm reading his story collection, A Good Fall, about Chinese immigrant community in Flushing, New York. These deceptively simple stories made me appreciate his wry humor and the memorable characters. It's a joy to read.
Oh, that's great. I think I have the novel Waiting, and I don't think I've read it yet. I'm going to have to go look. Okay, wonderful. So, Yang, can you tell us what you're working on now? Are you writing anything new?
Yes, I'm at work on a novel titled Oasis. I've been working on this book for years. The love story haunted and evolved with me.
Okay.
So, Lou, a boy, saves a girl, Kyra, from being drowned in a flash flood. They grow up in Mingqing, an oasis sandwiched between two deserts in northwestern China. Kyra leaves home to study and become a radiologist. Lou stays behind, raises a family in the diminishing oasis, which slowly dries up and becomes a desert. This is a story about unrequited love, economical development at the cost of environmental degradation, and one's lifelong obsession with one's birthplace. Kyra leaves her village, but her village has never left her.
That sounds wonderful. How far are you in it?
I've done two drafts, and I need to shorten the book and deepen some of the themes.
Okay, great. So do you write long and then edit short? Does that tend to be your pattern?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Living Treasure starts with 120,000 words.
Oh my gosh.
I cut it back to 80,000. I think it might be similar with this book.
Wow.
Yeah, I look forward to working on it.
Yeah, but that's hard cutting a third of a book. Do you find that refreshing or is it hard for you?
It's both. It's hard to lose the material you pour so much love into. On the other hand, you love those characters so much, you want to make them more vivid and interesting for the readers, and you give them more tests so they can come through as someone who really surprised you. This is a wonderful discovery, and mm-hmm. that's why I write novels.
Yeah, yeah, okay, great. I'm going to just return to my old faithful for one more question about it. As I already said, I just loved learning more about this culture that the family lives in, while also recognizing the shared universal humanity that the characters, you know, share with all of us. And I wondered if you have any advice for people who are perhaps writing books about other cultures for bringing through that which readers will recognize and find comforting while they learn something outside of their normal comfort zone, maybe.
I would advise people to write what moves you, what makes you scared. You have to be authentic and just... I think the story and characters always come before the subject matter. I usually think of a moment that in the character's life that makes me want to discover why this makes the character interesting. Then I go to research the subject. I read a lot of books on. I read 20 nonfiction books on dogs and watched dog themed films.
Really?
For Pining Yellow, yes. And I researched Indian food for The Gourmet. And I researched about fishing for The Umbrella.
Yeah.
So I think the story and character always come first. Then you do your research. That you need to know your subject, build the world from ground up. Like building a movie set, then you inhabit that space, live the story, and move and see the world through the character's eyes. Eventually, the plot will emerge organically from the nonfiction material as if I have lived through this story, like my own life. Then I don't have to force characters act in a certain way. Eventually, they reveal themselves to me.
So before you researched dogs, you already knew who, I'm going to say the name, I hope I say it right, Wei, is that how you say his name?
Yes.
You know, you already knew who he was, the little boy, and you knew what his character was. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That's.
But I didn't know what he's about to do and how he's going to get out of this sadness and desperation. So I know he wants Doc. So I want to feel about that loss as deeply as he does. Then I found the story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. That's really helpful. That's wonderful advice, I think, for writers to hear. Yang Huang has written a book of stories called My Old Faithful, and they are published by the University of Massachusetts Press, winner of the Juniper Prize for Fiction. So, Yang, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much. It's a wonderful conversation.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author Yang Huang. You can learn more about her work at yanghuang.com or follow her on Twitter at yangwrites. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Yang Huang. Alter the rhythm of your writing to jog your creative mind. First, work on a problematic scene by focusing closely on the language, painstakingly going over every word choice until you make it work or realize this needs to be cut. After a short break, return to the desk and write as fast as you can, hardly reading what you write. Silence the inner critic for the time being and set your mind free. Write for an hour until you slow down or you want to read over the passage. Then sleep on it. Edit the passage the next day and throw away any material you cannot use. Analyze the movement in your narrative. What have you discovered about the story and the characters? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at 99.3wbtv.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.